I get AI is going to make a difference and all that, but the reality is, to run the world, you still need capital, labor, and energy.
Energy.
And energy is a massive component of that.
Oil and gas makes modern life possible. The energy the world requires today and tomorrow will come from decisions made in the oil field today. Oil and gas will remain the leading source of fuel to power affordable energy that is sustainable for the billions of people that depend on the success of the industry. The oil field is a group of people, companies, technologies, and institutions working towards providing the world with safe, clean, storable, and transportable power. The Oilfield 360 podcast is a 360-degree deep dive into the leaders of the industry who will provide listeners with a first-hand account of what it takes to build, maintain, and lead the energy business into the future. The Oilfield 360 podcast is brought to you by the following sponsors: Locked In Global Energy and Marine, uncommonly independent. Locked In is the world's largest privately owned insurance broker and risk finance advisor. Locked In's global energy expertise is centered in Houston and represents the largest concentration of energy specialists, clients, and experiential knowledge in the upstream, midstream, and downstream segments of the oil and gas industry. Visit LockedIn.com for more information. Upright Digital. Upright Digital specializes in partnering with your business to maximize marketing efficiencies. We have a deep understanding of people, their needs, motivations, behaviors, as well as the technologies that enable brands in many industries to utilize what is available in a changing digital landscape. Find us online at uprightdigital.com.
Welcome to the Oilfield 360 podcast. I'm David Derode, your host, joined with my co-host extraordinaire, Jim Wicklund. Jim, how are you doing today?
Fabulous. Fabulous. Having a wonderful day, and I get to spend the day with friends.
It's been a fun day thus far.
It has, which followed a fun night last night and a fun day yesterday. I'm having too much fun. I need to stop this.
And a fun night tonight.
A fun night tonight. There's this very, very interesting and entertaining dinner tonight that I'm really looking forward to going.
Oh, yeah? What kind of dinner is that?
There's this guy named Marshall Atkins.
Who's that?
That guy.
Oh, okay.
And he puts on one of the most interesting and popular dinners of the year during NAEP. And I get to go learn something.
Yes. You know, I'm going to be like Lauren Singletary. I'm going to learn something new every day.
And, there you go.
And I'm looking forward to it as well. So, with that being said, I'd like to introduce our guest, Marshall Atkins, head of energy investment banking at Raymond James. Couldn't talk for a second.
Yeah, it's still hard for me to get used to it, too. Yeah.
Managing director, but so much more. Marshall has been a fixture in our industry for a number of years, and certainly a sage that many people talk to on a fairly regular basis, and it's a pleasure to have you here.
Great to be here. Love you guys.
Fabulous to be called a sage, too. I like that.
Yeah, it's a little generous, but let's go with it.
Congratulations. I'm proud of you.
Yeah. I've been called a lot of worse things.
And frequently, yeah, that's great.
So, as y'all can probably tell, this is going to be a fun podcast. These two characters have known each other for many moons, and I can't wait to get into it. So, with that being said, Marshall, we kind of like to always start these conversations, give our listeners kind of a little bit of background on who they're hearing from. And so would you mind kind of giving us a little bit of background on yourself, where you're from, and ultimately how you got into the oil and gas business?
Well, I was born a rich white kid from Houston, and it was all downhill from there. So
gotcha.
Yeah, grew up here in Houston, homegrown.
What high school?
Kincaid.
Okay.
My mom actually was born in Houston, which is rare. Pretty unique because that's probably when there's 150,000 people living in Houston. And so we go a ways back. And anyway, matriculated to UT like a lot of Texas guys did back when it wasn't hard to get into where you could.
Do you think you could get in today?
Oh, hell no.
Yeah.
No, there's no way.
You
know, and at the time, you know, all my buddies been oil field, you know, parents and whatnot. I'm like, well, you know, brilliant me. I say, well, I'm going to college. What do you want to do? I'm like, well, I don't know. They're like, what do you know at age 18? You don't know anything.
You don't know what jobs there are.
Of course not. But I knew enough to look at, all right, what are they paying guys for different degrees? And the highest paying degree was petroleum engineer. I'm like, well, that's what I want to do. So I went and to UT, got a petroleum engineering degree.
Okay, hold on. How many siblings in your family?
I've got one younger brother.
Okay.
Just two of us.
Is he in the oil business?
He's not in the oil business. He's in the real estate business.
Oh, he was the smart one. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and you went to Kincaid. Did you play any sports?
Played all the sports, just about. I was a four-letter athlete there for a while until they said you can only do three given the season. So, yeah, by the end I was doing track and basketball and football. I still hold out. I was probably the best quarterback Kincaid has ever had. Although there's a handful of quarterbacks that would dispute that. In fact,
more 47 of them left, I checked.
Probably more than that. Exactly.
Okay, so you go to Texas. What fraternity did you join?
Pledge Fiji with 42 of my other brothers.
Those are friends.
Yeah. I think maybe 18 or 20 of us ended up graduating. We had a lot of fun. Yeah, Texas was a blast. And, you know, I did graduate school, which was nice.
How many years?
Four and a half.
Okay. Well done.
The interesting thing about petroleum engineering at the time at UT was they let everyone in automatically. Then they figured out, because apparently a lot of kids had done the same thing I did, looking at what pays the most. Well, we only graduate 150 out of this at most, probably 125, and there's 400 signed up and in the freshman class.
Flunk them out.
So let's just flunk them out. The average GPA of the graduating class I was in was a 2.4.
Wow.
Jeez. Yeah,
they flunked a lot of us out.
A lot of people.
I made it. I just endured the pain and, you know, embraced the pain, which actually prepared me well for the next 30-something years in the energy business.
So how? What year did you graduate from college?
Graduated in 85. And
what a great year to get into the oil business.
Yeah, it was a wonderful year to get. Well, there was no jobs.
There were no jobs. Geologists, PhD geologists were driving taxis.
Yeah, it was a disaster. But they needed frac hands in the panhandle. So I got a job with BJ Services as a frac engineer. But that was back before frac guys were evil and bad people. You know, and you ask somebody today, well, you know, when was fracking? Oh, well, just a couple of years ago with the shale boom. Like, no, we'd actually been doing it for 30, 40 years before I started in the mid-'80s.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd fracked hundreds of thousands of wells at that point.
1948,
in time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it wasn't like it was new stuff. But it was a wonderful experience and, you know, at the time, miserable, right? And you guys been in the oil field, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It was 20-hour days. I'm sleeping on location. The first year, you know, I've got all these young analysts that work in banking now bitching about the 15-hour days. And 16,
in an air-conditioned building? Yeah.
Yeah, sitting down, and I'm like, well, actually, I've probably worked 20 hours. You can't work 20 hours. Well, you're right, but I slept on location and would wake up every couple hours to make sure this was going on. I maybe got 4 hours of sleep a night, so I don't know. 20 hours seems pretty close to me. And by the way, it was a full year without a day off. Right, it was like nonstop.
Yep.
Because we went frack job to frack job to frack job. It wasn't like today where you set up one time on location.
Or the offshore guys that were on 2 weeks, off 2 weeks. We never had the off 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. So, but you get 3 years of experience in a year. And it was, it gives you a work ethic. Like when I moved into sales, they're like, hey, you know a lot about this engineering. You actually can speak as an engineer. So we're going to move you to sales. I'm like, oh, that sounds really good. You're like, I get a desk and I sit in an air conditioned office. Yeah, I'm in. And so sure enough, I did that. But it's like, what am I going to do with all the rest of my time? Right? I mean, I'm, you know, still felt like I had to be there at least 12 hours a day, and I was working half time.
Yeah.
It was just, so it ingrained that work ethic, I think, which is important for young people, right?
Absolutely.
I remember when I moved inside.
Yeah.
I was on a seismic crew, and you worked from 6 in the morning till 7 at night, and you did it 6 days a week. You didn't work on Sunday, but you were living in Beeville, Texas, doing it. But like I say, it was, then I moved to Houston, and it was like, you know, 5 o'clock, they'd come by and turn off the lights and say, it's time to go home.
Yeah. But it just an incredible experience. And working in the panhandle was just totally different. You come from Houston, right?
And that's a different climate, yeah.
Yeah, you go up there and there's a girl behind every tree. for those of you that have never been to the panhandle, it's there's not any trees there.
So there are no girls to be behind them either?
Not a whole lot, no.
You can smell the money, and you can step on your dip can and watch your dog run away from you for 3 days.
Yeah. It's but what a phenomenal experience, and just totally different from Houston. And I remember watching the weather, you know, and it'd be like 12 degrees up there in Amarillo and 70 degrees here in Houston. I'm like, what am I doing here? This is miserable. So, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. And, you know, it makes you who you are.
Where did you go after a year on the panhandle?
Well, as a year as a frac engineer, maybe a year and a half. Then I was transferred to Amarillo in sales.
Okay.
And made some of my lifelong friends there in Amarillo, other engineers and stuff, because my job was to go entertain in sales. So it was like, well, here's $200. You got to spend $200 a week on entertainment. Well, spending $200 a week when it's nickel beer night,
yeah,
you know, in Amarillo, was not an easy thing to do. So,
makes you popular in a hurry, though.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun. we had a lot of fun, and so I did that for a year, and finally figured out, wait a minute, this is a horrible business. The rig count had gone from, what, probably 2,500 to 600 rigs, something like that, at the time.
Yeah.
And
on its way down from 4,581, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just what a disaster. And I'm like, this is a horror. I need to get out of this business. So I went back to business school. And I'm like, I really liked Austin. Austin was kind of cool. I went, let's go back and do something in Austin. Oh, I'll get a master's in business. Why not? And so did that for a couple years from 87 to 89.
Who was running BJ at the time when you worked for
Bill Stewart?
It was Bill.
Bill,
yeah. It was Bill, and it wasn't BJ Sir, it was BJ Titan, and, you know, it went through multiple iterations,
right,
before it ended up there. And Bill was just a very gracious and incredible person, and basically when I said I want to go back to business, he goes, hey, we'll keep you on the payroll, you know, paying my insurance and stuff like that. Just come back to us afterwards. I'm like, okay.
So you did?
Yeah, so I did. That's when I worked for, under McShane and and Matt Fitzgerald. And that was just a true eye-opening experience.
Great guy.
Yeah, yeah, terrific.
And then there was
a very well-run company.
Oh, exceptionally, I mean, famously, if you would, well-run company.
Yeah.
Okay, now, this is where an interesting thing happened.
Yes.
I get a call one day from the CFO of Intera, a guy I'd covered for a long time. And I had just left Epler, Guerin, and Turner, a little brokerage firm in Dallas, and gone to Rauscher Pierce. So Steve Grant calls me up. He goes, Jim, I've got a son-in-law who would be great at what you do. And I said, really? He goes, yeah, he's a petroleum engineer, frac engineer, MBA from Texas, works for BJ Services. He'd be great at what you do. And I said, you know, I have never met him. Had never met him. Just knew Grant, Steve. So I said, let me make a call. And my old shop, Epler, Guerin, and Turner, was looking for an analyst.
Right. This was early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And
I didn't know that connection between y'all two.
Yeah, that's exactly. Well, and at BJ, while I was there, we went public.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't such a thing as an IR guy, and McShane and them were just getting inundated. He goes, here, you talk to these analyst guys. You know, so I got to know a lot of the other analysts in the industry, so I knew what the gig was. And then the Epler, Guerin, Turner came to me and offered me like twice what I was making. I'm like, well, this is a really tough okay, yeah, I'll take it. Yeah.
it was at that point in time, I don't think it's definitely not the case anymore, but it was, we can't pay you what I'm sure you were making running those 300 people at that really corporation that you worked for, but we can pay you this.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was like, okay, I'll go ahead and take it.
So you go from actually contributing to society in a real company to now you're on the dark side, just giving your opinion on what people, I mean, technically, I guess we're capital allocators, we're helping the system, but it just seemed like it was cheating. And but what a fun job.
You get paid decently.
Yes.
To read, learn, analyze, and then give your opinion. And I can't think of, I'm still stunned that anybody would pay us for an opinion, but they have for years. And I just think I always wanted to be a scientist. You wanted to be, you know, it's been the greatest job I could ever imagine.
And I'd add to that, every day part of that job is talking to really smart people that do the same thing as you.
Yes.
You know, buy-siders that are the smartest people in the world on whatever subject that you're pushing. And it's just, it's wonderful being able to, you know, learn more and test wits and hone your thesis by discussions with these guys. So I did that with Jim's help at Epler, Guerin for a year. And then Raymond James, you know, had been knocking on the door, and I didn't know who Raymond James was. They weren't really that big in Texas. They're still a pretty small company at that point in time. And I really hadn't taken a vacation. You know, I'd been ramping up coverage, and you know the drill. It's just a lot of work. You know, didn't have junior analysts. It was like all me. And my wife Kim was just wearing me. We got to take a vacation. So Ram James says, yeah, we want you to interview over in Florida with her. I'm like, Florida? Well, can I bring my wife and my newborn baby and you put us up like on the beach or something? I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. So I'm like, check. I can get a vacation in and you'll pay for it. You know, I'm kind of cheap. I'm a Costco shopper, right? So it's like, yeah, sure, I'll go interview. And it was the most interesting interview process I've ever been through. I mean, it was a 3-hour test, literally like a SAT test.
Really?
And personality test. And, you know, you're sitting in this room, by the end, you're like, this is, the whole test here is, when are you going to get up and leave? Like, they got a camera on me. When are you going to just give it up and just say, I'm done?
Screw this, I'm done, yeah.
And so they did that. And then literally, you know, spent an hour with the CEO of the firm. You know, and I'm just a lowly analyst interviewing. And it was just such an impressive firm. And they gave me a wonderful offer. And so then I had to go back and tell my wife, well honey, we're moving to Florida. Yeah. Again, with her little, maybe it was approaching a year old at the time, and she's pregnant with the next one. And
you're going to move quick.
Yeah. So, that was, I moved to Raymond James, and that would have been in early 95, and been there ever since.
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, a long time.
Long time.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like that long, but.
You'll find this out as you get older like me, you know. 45 seems like 3 weeks ago, and so yeah. It's, when actually it was only like 6 years. Don't wish.
Well, that's the other thing. All the young kids that work for me, they're in their early 20s. I mean, I was in my 30s before I really moved on and became an analyst. I mean, I was well down the path of
36
of a career. Yeah. And, you know, and really did that for 25 years and loved, I like to say loved every minute, but, you know, if I'm a morning workout guy, right? So if you want to work out in the morning and get to the office by 6, you're getting up pretty damn early. And so,
yes.
So that wears on you a little bit, but,
yeah, but if you only do it for 20, 25 years, you know.
Yeah. And as Jim, as you well know, it's like, yeah, when you're usually gone at least 2 or 3 days a week, minimum every other week, a lot of times every week. Which, you know, God bless my wife, you know, when you have little kids, you really need that time off in the middle of the week.
You do.
So, and she'd be there taking care of them. She was just such a saint.
I don't think most people, and I know I didn't realize it when I came into this, is how much travel it actually was. And the firms would say, look, you know, we can do conference calls. This was before Zoom.
Right.
We can do different things. You don't need to travel that much. And it turns out you only needed to travel if you wanted to be successful.
Yep.
And something about this guy, and I think I share at least a little bit of the trait, is we're kind of driven.
Yeah.
And so it was like Melissa Kugel was saying, you know, always finish.
Yeah.
And so if you want to be a really good analyst, you travel your ass off.
Yep. And again, you get to interact with these really smart people. You know, now some of them are the 23-year-old. You know,
the analysts were tough. Portfolio managers, much better.
Yeah, and they, the 23-year-olds, knows more than you at 45, and you're just looking at them like, yeah, okay, give it a break, dude. But again, you have to adapt to that type of. Person, because they're clients, they're guys that are going to pay you. Then you have to really speak up to the guys that are right on your level and speak in your language and going to challenge you on different things.
So,
Lauren made the comment, you have to learn every day.
Oh, yeah.
As an analyst,
yep.
There is a volume of data you have to learn every day, not one thing.
And you also, and if you don't know this going in, you'll quickly learn it by being humbled. You're not going to get it all right. It's, yeah. You know, if you get it right 55% of the time, you're
doing hero.
Pretty good. And the answer isn't so much sticking to a theme, whether it's bullish or bearish, but it's taking the data in and adjusting your theme to accommodate what is the data telling you. And those that get stuck on, oh, well, I'm really bullish on this stock or whatever. If the data changes, you got to change.
That was one of the biggest issues. And I know in politics we call it wishy-washy or flip-flops. I consider it an evolution of your thinking.
Yeah.
Because if you are stuck on a stock, I love them, I have a buy rating on them forever, and then the data changes and you ignore the data, you're no longer an analyst.
Yeah. And there's management teams that you love, right? That are really good, and you know they're great, but
can't you know, recommend their stock.
It's not all the time their stock's going to go up.
Yeah. So, what was the biggest? What was the biggest challenge, family wise, of being an analyst? Leaving Kim at home with the kids, and
yeah, again, so when I started Epler, she was pregnant here in Houston, still working for a law firm, and. And I went up there for the first 6 months just to...
Up to Dallas.
Up to Dallas, thank you. And rolling out coverage. And I'm working 16-plus hour days because you grind it out just to get coverage up and running before you're talking to clients all the time. So rolling out coverage initially, I was up there on my own. She's down here pregnant. And then finally moved up there with me, had the kid. Then we did the same thing again, moving to Raymond James, where she was in Dallas for 3, 4, 5 months. I forgot how long. And I was in Florida for those 5 months, kind of commuting as I rolled out in coverage, same deal. Leaving her there alone, she did a phenomenal job. That's one of the things I hear the young people these days talking about. Well, I can't do this. I can't do that. I'm like, yeah. It's a partnership. You do what you need to do to succeed. And
now, one point I want to bring up when he says, he was putting out coverage. Never been an analyst before. You have no associates. You've never been an associate work for an analyst, which is how you learn how to do this.
Yes.
So you have to learn this on the fly. You have to build earnings models, which as an engineer, we never had to build income statements and cash flow statements.
Right.
And so what was interesting, because we both had the same start experience, Epligaren was my first job too, is it is the most trial by fire, because there's no one to say, this is how we build models. This is how we do X. You just have to kind of look at other people's reports and say, well, I guess that's a good one. I'll try and look something like that. And I think that what was interesting is you and I both learned in 1 year at Epler more than any intern has ever learned in their first or associate in their first 3 years. Easy.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure. It's looking at other people's stuff. And then I did have a master in business. So, a new income statement balance sheet versus just engineering. But still, it's a whole new deal, yep. Right? It was such a great learning experience. You phrase it perfectly.
But I think what's interesting about when I think about you and Jim and some other folks that are so-called analysts and research guys is that there's a number of folks that are filling those roles that have actually not ever worked in the industry that they are providing advice and research on. And I think the one thing about your background and Jim's is that you worked in the business, and not only did you work in the business, you have relationships with guys at the field level all the way up to the boardroom. And that to me is material and meaningful. And similarly to like our buddy John Daniel, how he got his start, well, I think he's been successful. I'd say the same with you and Jim. Jim's work as geophysicist and what he's done there, and your work as a frac engineer. I mean, that's so. There's always pay attention to folks that really understand what they're talking about, or become a student of what they're talking about, or become a fabric of it. And that's always something I've respected about you and Jim.
It's hard for them to bullshit you.
Exactly.
If a frac guy's out there trying to bullshit you, and you've actually been an engineer in charge of a frac spread, there's not a lot he's going to, say that you don't already know.
Magnetic Resonance Imaging was a company in our industry, and they came out one day at an analyst meeting and said they had discovered a direct hydrocarbon indicator tool, and everybody's running for the exits to make phone calls. Oh my God, a direct hydrocarbon tool. And I raised my hand and I said, you treat pore throat size as a constant, so you can't tell the difference between irreducible water and oil. So how does that work? And the guy looked at me and said, who the hell are you and what are you doing in here?
Yeah.
It's a better bullshit filter.
Sure.
One company, Kelly Oil, had made this giant discovery, and this analyst in Chicago had written it up. It was the biggest gas discovery ever. And the IR guy said, Jim, you need to come down to our office and look at this log. And I said, well, I'm not a very good petrophysicist, but I've been reading logs for 30 years. I'd love to. He goes, well, then wait, don't do that.
Yeah.
Just read her report. She had misplaced a decimal point.
Oops.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it does. You're right. It provides a perspective that not a lot of people have. The other thing, I was fortunate, having worked for Mike McShane and Matt Fitzgerald, the BJ system at the time had inherited the Baker planning system, which was the most detailed planning system out there. And so you have an appreciation for the behind the scenes of what the finance side's going through. And, you know, that's actually hard work. That's real work versus analysts. We're just, you know, modeling, okay, this is what we think's going to happen. They've got to get all that stuff right.
Yep.
And having that appreciation for actually how it works behind the scenes is really important when you're talking to CFOs about the numbers and, wait, how did you miss this or that? And, yeah, I knew exactly how they missed this or that because, you know, if you've been involved in that, you learn.
I think the other thing it does is that a lot of analysts who – and the way it works is almost perverse. A guy graduates from MBA school. He got a job with Credit Suisse Research. He comes in, and the research director says, okay, who needs help? And if the restaurant analyst raises his hand, that guy goes to work for the restaurant analyst, and he's now pigeonholed in restaurants the rest of his life. We didn't have a choice. There was only one sector we could cover. But so many of those analysts who do that don't have appreciation of culture inside of a company. And having worked inside of companies and understanding the importance of culture, and you mentioned BJ because BJ had one of the best cultures in the industry at the time, is something that a lot of the analysts didn't even know they were missing.
Right. Yeah, the executive suites under McShane, I think back to the guys I worked with there, and there were four or five of those people that became either CEOs or CFOs at significant companies down the road. And I was the lowly performer of the group. Culture, Matt. And young kids these days, when they're interviewing for jobs, you know, it's like when I was 18. It's like, well, how much am I going to make? And that's all I care about. Oh, no. You need to be finding out about the culture of wherever you're going because it matters. It's a huge deal as to how everyone treats each other. The excitement there, the camaraderie, the teamwork, et cetera, et cetera. It matters in a big way, and it's certainly something, you know, in my current role, I try to make sure we focus, number one, on culture, and then the rest of it seems to fall into place.
So you mentioned kids, you know, these young kids today. You've got a couple.
Got three boys. Yep. I've got three boys, and
they didn't make baristas. I heard that they wanted to be baristas, but they didn't make it. What happened to them?
Well, one of them does spend quite a bit too much time researching various bourbons and whiskeys.
He's That's an not ex- wasted time.
Yeah. He's an expert on that. But both of them got petroleum engineering degrees from UT. There's no way I could have gotten in. Like when they got in, the average, this is going to blow you away, the average SAT equivalent, either the ACT or S, but the SAT equivalent, what you and I think about, of the freshman class is where that they were in at UT was like a 1480 SAT average.
Jesus.
Think about that just for a minute. When I went to UT, if you had anything over 1,000, automatically in.
So you're saying Kim contributed greater to their intellectual capabilities.
Well, I'll let people make their own judgment, but that's the conclusion most people do come to. Yes, exactly. And then we have the caboose, 7 years after the last one. And he's at Trinity right now. And is, I said, look, you can do anything but oil and gas. No oil and gas.
You got to get a little diversification in the family.
You got to do something different. So he's a computer science guy. And
that's a bad place to be.
Yeah.
Family of underachievers.
And I'm so proud. He made the dean's list this semester, and it's like, as a parent, that's, you're like, oh, this is awesome. This is good.
Doesn't get better than that. Congratulations.
Yeah. So yeah, three boys. You know, once you have one boy, you figure out. I mean, they're easy, right? If you have a boy, girl, and others, oh, that's just the best thing. It's like, yeah, but you got to learn a whole different game.
Yeah.
Right. They're just, you
got good at drywall repair, I bet.
Yeah. Oh well. Yeah.
I see why Kim's the toughest one in the room.
Yeah, no, they it was mayhem. It was mayhem. A lot of sports, you know, a lot of, you know, all the stuff and that boys do. So
as an analyst, one of the things that a lot of people do as an analyst is, you know, it could be X or it could be Y. Oil prices could go up or they could go down, or, you know, and it always got me that so many people that we competed against stayed in the business by never having an opinion.
Yeah.
You and I are notable in our group for always having an opinion, even if it wasn't right.
You guys have opinions?
Occasionally. What's behind the self-confidence required to have strong opinions? What's been the driver in your life, whether you're a kid or whatever, to come out and have a strong opinion about something, take something in somebody?
Right. Let's start out with having an opinion as an analyst. There's, so, to your point, so many people in this industry that I knew are cross paths. I mean, it was like the typical economist. Well, on this hand, this could happen. On this hand, that could happen. And it's going to be somewhere in between. And you don't get paid for that.
No.
You get paid to have an opinion. Now, you need to understand all sides of the issue. You want to be able to argue both the bull and the bear case of whatever. But whatever side you come down on, you better, you know, make that call and stick to it and be confident in it until the data changes. Mm-hmm. Then you change it.
Well put.
And so, you know, a big part of the confidence comes with just doing the damn work, right? I mean, it's, you're putting in the time and you know, if it comes to oil prices, well, I'm going to examine every little aspect and talk to everyone I can and bounce this idea off of really smart guys and where I know more than everyone else does. Great example of this is back in, it would have been the late 90s. And natural gas was the thing, right? Oil wasn't the thing. Everyone's drilling for gas, and it was, you know, all about gas.
We were the gas service business, according to Mark Siegel at Patterson, yeah.
Right. And you know, so Dave Baldwin, a good friend of, I think, all of ours, I was talking about gas. He goes, hey, you need to talk to this guy named George Kaiser, because he's the only other one I know that knows gas as well as you. I'm like, sure, I'll call. I don't know who George is, right? I'm just some guy, right? So I call him up, and I spend an hour on the phone with him. And, you know, after that, I'm like, holy crap. I need to rethink two or three things that I was talking about. He knew so much about the gas market. Again, at this time, I don't know that, like, he's a billionaire, right? It's just some dude.
Yeah.
But he knew his shit about gas. And that was just fun for me. I was like, oh, this is good. Because if somebody can poke a hole in my thesis, I want to know what that hole is.
Absolutely.
To get it right. Now, I think I probably poked a few holes in his thesis on different aspects of it. And I just love that. You know, that to me, it's getting it right.
Yep, being right.
And then once you've gone through that, And it's hard for others to poke holes in it, then you're going to have the confidence to make that call.
Did sports, what happened earlier in your life that, I mean, have you always been a forthright captain of the football team, president of the senior class, any of those things?
Yeah, again, I focused on the sports a lot.
Okay.
So
that's leadership.
Yeah, there wasn't there wasn't any, you know, master plan of head student government like some of these guys today. Like, they're doing all of this stuff, and I'm like, no, I didn't have time. I'm just, you know, I got to go to practice. This is, you know, I got to go, you know, run a few extra laps around the whatever. But the teamwork associated with, you know, the sports, whether it's, you know, basketball or football, obviously less so track, for sure is a huge part of, you know, what I do today. But I think it also gives you confidence in everything in your life.
Yes, it does.
So, at the time you're not thinking that, right? You take for granted, you know, what you're doing. Yep. You know, I look back on it, and for sure the sports aspect and having that, the ability to do that. That's one of the things that worries me about the system these days. You know, back then you could play three sports.
Yeah.
Right? There was time and they encouraged that. Now kids are pigeonholed into one sport, doing it year round. You know, I started on the basketball team as a junior. I started on the football team as a sophomore, and then of course ran track from the time I was a freshman on. You know, it was awesome being able to do all of those different things, whereas today you can't.
Well, it also gives you well-rounded confidence. I was listening to something on the radio the other day, and they were talking about how the kids will just play one sport, practice it 12 months a year, hire a pro, and the doctors say that their bodies break down so much more quickly, it's ridiculous.
Right.
And that doing multi-sports is the best thing a kid can do for one. But it just struck me that doing multiple sports instead of being chained to trying to be really good at one thing, versatility, adaptability, those to me have been the most important parts of my life.
Sure.
And so I think doing a number of different things and being decent at them has to instill you with a confidence.
You know, I will tell you, if you know, because I've looked at this in successful people, it is uncanny how many successful people that you're around actually were sports fanatics in their younger days, that they just did.
They know how to compete.
Right.
And they want to compete.
Right. Yeah.
So let's talk about some stuff that might be of, not that all this is not of interest, but I know certainly of things that y'all like to talk about, we like to talk about, but kind of your views on the world today and the dynamics facing energy as a whole, but also world events, etc. You want to leap into that, do you think?
The condition of the world today is scary, though I think it all, frankly, right now centers on Iran. We have turned a blind eye toward Iran while they boosted their production dramatically. Marshall has numbers better than me. And now we're scared to death to do something directly to Iran and create another war. And their proxies are now shutting down the Red Sea. And a year and a half after, well, the Ukraine war, a year and a half, and now we've had the Israeli-Gaza conflict, and U.S. has been hit, facilities have been hit over 100 times since October 6th. And so it's like when Jimmy Carter was president and everybody said, well, let's bomb Americans something because we won't know they won't do anything. It's made it less safe for Americans overseas. And in our business, I mean, the risk premium doesn't seem to be there, which is stunning to me. And all of this is going to come to a head at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. So I am, you know, first of all, I often get accused of being a perma bull. Because I've been bullish for quite a few years here, and I think the writing's been on the wall for a while. As you starve an industry of capital, the consequences will come home to roost. You know, the timing of that's going to vary. But I think the next decade for conventional oil and gas is going to be phenomenally good. You know, it's the opposite end of the spectrum of me getting into petroleum engineering in the early 80s at the peak. You want to get in energy at the bottom. And we've had, you know, the equivalent of two Saudi Arabias brought online from the U.S. over the past decade. You know, one in gas, one in oil. Mm-hmm. And that's caused energy prices and oil prices specifically to be extraordinarily low for a decade. So you've had cheap energy. You've had free money for 20 years, certainly 15.
Easily 15, yeah.
You've had free or cheap labor as we've outsourced everything to China over the past 20 years. Every one of those things is coming to an end.
That's correct.
And specifically as it relates to the oil sector, I don't think the general market really appreciates how precarious the situation is out there in terms of supply and demand. The market's been convinced by the ESG movement and the coasts in the U.S. and by Europe that there is an easy replacement for hydrocarbons. And the reality says, and we've got all kinds of numbers that we don't need to get into, that says, no, it's just the opposite. This is going to take a long, long time. And if you rush it too much, then the ability to thrive in life goes away.
Yeah.
It costs a lot more. Look at Germany, whose electric prices are four times higher than ours are today here in the United States.
And they set a record for burning coal last year.
Yeah. Their industry, which they rely on for a lot of their exports, just industrial output is down 20-something percent in Germany as energy's become more. Energy is the building block of everything you do in the economy. It's the reason we were able to go from less than a billion people globally 150 years ago to 8 billion people. Without that energy, that would have never happened.
But I think this is something I've been saying, and I agree with you. But I think this is where I think the industry needs to do a really good job in choosing their words. And what I mean by that is energy can be nuclear, wind, solar, this, that, and the other. What you're talking about, what I'm talking about, is oil and gas. And while they're hydrocarbons, you know, I think the one thing that we've not done a very good job as an industry focusing on, as well as what we're educating people on, is that you've got two different kind of usage buckets for hydrocarbons. You've got the transportation fuel and the ability to generate power, you know, in one bucket. And then you've got the, you know, petrochemistry and their derivatives in another bucket. So even if you go, okay, we're going to use nuclear to produce electricity, or we're going to use coal to produce electricity, or whatever, or hydro, you know, forget gas for a second, or even, you know, using oil, you still have petrochemistry, to your point, which I loved hearing, our ability to thrive. And quite frankly, oil and gas, it is not really an industry as much as the underpinning of the economy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, dependable, low cost, readily available, you know, storable and transportable oil and gas is what's made things happen, and so much so to where our global population has grown. And so while people think the demand for oil and gas is going down, it's actually going up. And you know, that's what is so frustrating is the lack of true awareness and knowledge around this whole topic is quite baffling and frustrating. And I do think that chickens are going to come home to roost.
It's incredibly frustrating as somebody that's been in the industry and as an engineer, right? You just run the math and you're like, wait a minute.
That's the problem.
You know, you run the math like, no, you guys don't understand. Energy return on energy invested for wind and solar don't allow you, you know, to, particularly if you have to incorporate batteries and all the other expenses, to deliver cost-effective, reliable energy on the electric grid side, right? So natural gas is competing with that.
Right.
And very favorably. That's why we're the one country that, you know, didn't sign the Paris Accord that's actually hit our goals in terms of reducing carbon footprint, because we've gone to gas.
Right.
And they still want to shut that down per the LNG thing. And we've got a ton of gas here that's low cost effective. I don't know what you guys are paying in Texas for your electric bill, but I'm at about 7 cents a kilowatt hour. Germany's at 45 cents.
I know.
So, and that's retail customer, you know, for the U.S. And so it's like, gas is cheap and affordable and reliable, right? The petrochemical thing about of oil, or let's say liquids, petroleum, about a third of that goes to the petrochem side, which is Jim's polyester suit right there. You know, and his spandex that I know he's wearing.
My spandex, my Spanx, you know, on here. Men's Spanx, yeah.
All of that stuff. So that's going to happen regardless, right? That's a steady growth, and that doesn't go away. I mean, even the Teslas and whatever are all being made out of oil and gas, hydrocarbons. You know, it's hard to get tires.
The super glue that the activists are gluing their hands to things, super glue.
Yeah, it's and the activists don't get. I mean, it's just like it's a religion, so they're not going to listen to any of the other stuff. On the transportation side, and Robert Bryce put this the best, he goes, if you were going to invent the perfect fuel for transportation, you would have invented oil or liquids, gasoline, diesel, etc., as your fueling source.
Yeah.
Right, it's
what you would have invented if you didn't have it. Yep.
Yeah, it's easily, you know, transportable, and you can
energy density's high, everything.
Fill your car in 5 minutes as opposed to an hour and 5 minutes at Bucky's, you know, charging station, whatever. And time kind of, I don't know about you guys, time kind of matters to me. I love Bucky's. I could probably spend an hour in there buying crap I don't need.
Yeah, let's be honest here. You can get lost in Bucky's.
Yeah, I don't. But
that happened to me yesterday. Yeah.
My belly don't need that.
Yeah.
So, but there's a massive lack of understanding here. Here's a great statistic I saw the other day: is the average tenure of a financial advisor in the U.S. today. Is less than, or not average, 70% of the financial advisors have been in the industry less than 12 years. Well, if you've been a money manager, financial advisor, whatever, for less than a decade, it paid not to own oil and gas.
That is correct.
It paid not to know anything about oil and gas.
That's right.
Just buy tech, whatever. So you've got a preponderance of people running money now that have never seen an energy cycle. Well, energy cycles run in long-term cycles. It's 15-year type cycles. Well, if none of these guys have seen energy cycle, they're about to, and it's going to be a rude awakening. It's like we saw in 2000 with the tech meltdown. And for the next decade, energy outperformed everything else by a factor of 10. I think the next decade that we're going into right now, And I you can argue it started a couple of years ago because we've outperformed 2 out of 3 years, the market. That I think energy going forward is going to be the big outperformer in the market.
And we're arguing the laws of physics with people who are literary majors who think they understand the business.
Yes.
And with no offense meant, you know, practicality beats idealism every single time.
Exactly.
Just not as quickly as we'd like.
Yes.
And so on everything from EVs to oil use to coal use to all of this, it's great to have an opinion, and it's great to have a desire. And then there's the reality. And I just don't see that the reality is being understood. I have a slide in my deck that shows all the different things made from oil. And I've had people look at that and go, that's not right. Which ones aren't right? Well, all of them. That's all bullshit. And it's like, actually, I hate to tell you this, but it's really not.
Yeah.
And they are stunned. And to your point, there's transportation fuel, which gasoline is probably the second lowest utilization of the hydrocarbon behind right. burning oil for electricity. Okay. But everything, even my polyester suit, the buttons on your shirt, my glass, the phone.
Everything.
Everything. There was a hearing the other day, and this woman was saying we need to get rid of plastics.
That he did a wonderful job.
He did a wonderful job.
The guy from Oklahoma, I think. Yeah.
And he did a wonderful job going, oh, really? And these people have no clue.
Yeah.
And to your point, David said several times we've done a terrible job in educating. When it doesn't matter to them, they don't care to get educated.
Right.
And that's from laymen to the investors you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I need to know energy for 10 years. Why get to know them now?
But I'm going to ask a controversial question, maybe. Maybe not controversial to y'all, but maybe to the audience.
It's hard to shock either one of us, but go ahead.
But so we're talking about common sense and being pragmatic in our thinking. And, you know, I think there's you got the group that's useful idiots, the folks that have found their religion. But then you've got the folks that know better. What's the motivation behind not continuing to double down on oil and gas?
It's a great question. And there's a handful in our industry that have addressed it head on. Chris Wright, certainly Toby Rice.
Yep.
And a handful of Bud Brigham, a handful of others, right? That address and say, no, this isn't right, and they speak up. But if you're the CEO of Shell or Total or whatever, and they're throwing Molotov cocktails at your front door of your building, and you're being chastised by all of your buddies at cocktail parties in Europe and whatnot, well, you're going to cave. And that's exactly what Shell and BP and, you know, all those guys did is they felt like they had to cave and go all clean and green energy. Exxon wasn't doing it until, you know, somebody took over their board, said, no, you got to do that. And the board's finally come around and said, no, you guys are actually really good at finding oil and gas. Why don't you all just stick to doing that?
Isn't that great?
Because shareholders actually want to make money. So
I love how they pushed back against the activist shareholders the other day.
Yeah, tried to.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait a minute, you had the takeover of the activist years ago, and they've been on the board, you know, Engine One, been on the board and redirected for a while. And Exxon, I think the majority of energy companies I know are doing everything they can to make the world cleaner and better. And they're generally very responsible. Not all of them.
Most of them,
at least here in the U.S.
Yes.
Now, what the activists don't get is they're forcing all these sales of, oh, Shell needs to sell to get divest of this. All right, so you sell it to a local Nigerian company. How are they going to do for the environment? It's going to be a disaster. Right? So I wish, you know, I had a better answer, but there's a handful of people in our industry that stood up and say, hey, this doesn't make sense, and challenged it. But because there was such a polarization in this company and such a demonization of energy, it's hard if you're CEO to fight that, right? It's hard to go against what consensus and even most of your shareholders in the endowments and pension funds and whatnot, you know, state of California, whoever owns your stock, they're demonizing you for oil and gas. So you kind of have to play the game a little bit, when instead they should realize, well, they're going to get rid of my stock anyway. They're going to divest of all this stuff anyway.
I mean, it's like they're going to shoot you anyway, so why not do something about it?
Yeah.
And well, now I'm going to say that
the numbers that we forget about.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, I mean, as an industry in the U.S., we've been growing production so fast that the rest of the world's had to shut in production just to accommodate our growth. And while I understand infrastructure in the Marcellus for gas is woefully late thanks to government intervention, the U.S. government really hadn't done anything to slow down oil production, particularly in the U.S. in the last couple of years. We complain about Mr. Biden, but he's the one that approved the Willow Project in Alaska, and there's, other than shutting down federal government land, which got reversed almost immediately, there's been very little he's shut down. I also kind of disagree with the idea that we've grossly underfunded the industry for the last 10 years, because for 7 of those 10 years, we lost our asses, and if we'd have spent a lot more money, we would have lost a lot more money.
Right.
And if I would have invested a whole lot more in oil and gas over the last 10 years, what would my prices today be? Lower.
Right.
And so I would argue that so far, we have invested exactly the right amount of money in this industry, reinvested for the last many years. Here we are in 2024, and I got a $70 oil price, and companies are making money, 15% free cash flow yields. We didn't invest enough when. Now, going forward is the issue, because availability of capital, you've got the head of the UN, you got the former head of the UK, you've got our president exhorting to all international bodies, quit lending to these clowns. And going forward, banks, 25 banks will now loan in energy versus 50 4 years ago. And the cost of capital, prices, interest rates after decades, have moved up. And so I have a concern going forward, though we still have a couple million barrels that are off the market that can come in. So my concern over oil prices and gas prices to some extent, again, we've grown gas production while dropping the gas rig count from 1,600 in 08 to 79 in 2000 at the bottom of the pandemic, okay? 1,600 to 79, and gas production went up every year, okay? So this idea that we haven't invested enough over the last several years is sounds great when you talk about it's going to really come to haunt us over the next 10 years. We've been saying this for 10 years, and it hadn't come to haunt us yet either. So I'm not saying there's going to be continued leaps in technology like we've seen before, and I have no question the bias of oil prices is up, factors we mentioned. But I'm not so sure that we have to really care about educating the world. It would be nice not to be thought of as a pariah. But they need us whether they know it or not. And whether you don't like my product, but you keep buying it every day, if you loved my product, would you buy more? The answer is really no. We don't deal directly with retailers, with the retail world, gasoline, but that's different. And so I'm much more sanguine on the investment idea and investors' appeal to us. DEI is on the way out. ESG is getting marginalized. BlackRock, who famously 2 years ago said they're not going to invest in oil and gas, and 9 states said, fine, we're going to. And then last summer, they put the CEO of Aramco on the BlackRock board. If that isn't a concession, I don't know what is. So I, while we're all concerned about the future of funding and oil price and everything like that, you're also seeing a softening of the issues, ESG primarily, DEI to some extent, all of those kind of things that were roadblocks. So I'm a believer that it all kind of works out in the end, but is the bias toward commodity prices higher over time? It's easy to say yes, because I know what I spend for a candy bar now versus when I was a kid, but there is no question that as long as the industry stays profitable, investors will eventually come back, because the goal, as we've seen, all the ESG funds have underperformed the market dramatically. people want to make money when they invest money. So I'm not worried about them coming back. There will be many who miss the gravy train. That's their fault. And I think we're going to have an exceptionally healthy, realistic, good industry through the end of my life.
Yeah, so for most of our careers, we actually overfunded the industry, right? You know, E&P's outspent cash flow for the last 30 years, plus or minus, by, you know, 20%. Well, wait a minute. When are you going to get a return if you're outspending cash flow every damn
single year?
Until the last 3 years.
Right.
Right. And so there's no question the mentality has changed. And you pair that with two things. Number one, they're being forced to by capital starvation, pension funds, endowments. That's a, by the way, one interesting stat there in terms of will we see capital ever return here? The proliferation of family offices.
If you look at
money in the system from $5 million investors and over, it's $45 trillion. And those guys, a lot of those guys run their own stuff, right? Family offices, whatever. Pension and endowment funds now are down to $15 trillion. Trillion for the other ones, $15 trillion versus $45 trillion for family offices. The family offices, all they want is profits.
That's right.
And you know what?
Make money. Make a return.
They're going to get that in oil and gas.
But I thought that was the whole impetus for investing was to
make profit. It's to save the world, David.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. Sorry.
So, I mean, there's a lot of those family offices like the Rockefellers.
It's gotten huge, though.
Probably not going to invest in oil and gas. But you know, there's a lot that's like
I spoke at the Texas Family Office Association annual meeting in Fort Worth a couple months ago. They love oil because everybody's making so much money in it. And like you say, how much money they've got. Used to be a family office was $1 billion. Now there's so many billion-dollar family offices, but there's so many $300 million family offices, you'll choke. So I agree. That was very good point and a very missed area of capital that's emerging.
So I think that changes. The other thing I would point out as it relates to, you know, the trajectory of U.S. production, our ability to meet this going forward is, you know, for 5 years we've all been saying, all right, well, when does well productivity roll over? And it kept marching higher per well in the U.S. Now, a lot of the last 5 years has been just simply longer laterals, right? So the productivity for foot isn't changed that much, but longer laterals. Well, that's coming to an end. You're exhausting the best stuff. In 22, for the first year in a decade, we saw productivity per well roll over. Mm-hmm. It'll be 4 or 5 months before we get all the 23 data consolidated. But that I would guess at best that's flat. It's probably down again. So you're going to be fighting that trend with less capital for the time being.
Agreed.
And so therein lies the opportunity. That's why for the first time in our career, when do you ever recall Warren Buffett owning a conventional oil and gas company in your career? You know, pipeline, sure, but conventional oil and gas?
No.
Chevron, Oxy are 15% of his portfolio now.
I know.
Now, along with cash being
The
biggest part, and that gets back to your original question, is, all right, how worried are you about all of the stuff out there? I am really worried about the global economy. I know you look at the stock market today or any time recently, and the Magnificent Seven keep going up, you know, well, except for now Tesla. Actually, a friend of mine, Ted Oakley, made a good point the other day. He goes, yeah, I remember that movie, The Magnificent Seven. You probably remember
I
it.
Do.
You know, four of those guys
I
got
died.
Killed. you know, I think it's just a matter of time. It just so reminds me, because you and I have this perspective of 2000, right? Where I had my good buddies that were lawyers that were calling me about stock picks. I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, yeah, I'm buying whatever, I don't remember, Cisco, whatever it was at the time. And I'm like, what are you doing? Oh, yeah, I'll put big money into this. It just keeps going up. Well, I don't think we're that far from that right now in terms of valuations. So, and I get AI is going to make a difference and all that, but the reality is to run the world, you still need capital, labor, and energy.
Energy.
And energy is a massive component of that. And we're not bringing on enough new stuff to make a difference over the next 5 years. You know, is it 6 months? Is it a year? Is it 2? I don't know. It's, you know, the timing of the shortfalls.
Impossible.
It's my belief, though, and I'm not the expert you guys are, but I think we've been subsidizing the true cost of energy for way too damn long.
Of course.
I think it's way underpriced relative to its value. And I look at, okay, we hear the operators, the oil and gas companies, say what they say, but nobody's taking into consideration the impact this low cost of energy has had on the guys that actually help develop the hydrocarbons and actually, you know, bring it to a useful form for humanity in our wonderful global economy. And I think I agree with Jim to a degree, like, we shouldn't have to invest anymore. It's not capital starved. But if you think about the services sector, I think it is. I think
for sure.
Nobody appreciates the intensity at which we've been running this equipment. And that equipment has to be replaced and replenished at some point. And I still think that's underinvested in that regard. And then
agreed.
The continual cost of employment and training people, because this stuff is not robotic. And
it's just the oil companies don't really care.
I know they don't care.
I had a seismic company tell me once, well, they can't afford for us to go bankrupt. And I said, well, sure they can. You go bankrupt, the boat's still available. All those people are still available.
Different owner.
I can get the exact same crew 2 weeks after you go bankrupt at half the price.
Yeah.
And so there has never been an oil company that I'm aware of, an oil company's board, who said, let's pursue this strategic goal, but oh wait, let's do something different because that might hurt the service companies.
But I thought we were in this world of responsible investing. And why nobody has called that out.
The reality of the world is, until it becomes a shortage, whatever it is,
right,
it's not a problem. And so, you know, I look at so many things in the energy, conventional energy business today, starting with the service. They're not going to get pricing till you're out of it. And by the way, yeah, we're profitably finding oil at 70, 75, and everything's good, but the rig count's down 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because people think they're not making enough money in it right now, whether it's Saudi or the U.S. producers, whatever. Certainly, in the case of U.S. producers, you're down meaningfully in terms of activity. So you say, all right, well, what gets it up? Well, we've subsidized it for a decade. It's been the best thing to happen to our country. When the U.S. brings on 2 Saudi Arabia equivalents of energy, it is a gift that the American, you know, economy has that is massively underappreciated by the coasts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And the impact of that upon their well-being, their cost of living, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as soon as gasoline goes up to $5, they're going to squeal that we're the bad guys,
uh-huh,
right? But now it's the consequences of all the other garbage going on. So another great example of that is, look at the way oil trades today. Oil is dominated by these algorithm quant funds, right? And they, as you well know, Jim, they're just looking at, you know, technical indicators, short-term direction indicators. They're looking at just a formula they come up with for different things. But for the most part, they're not massively fundamental driven.
Barely at all fundamental driven.
Because they're very short-term models.
Right.
Where my point would be, just like the services side, over time, the fundamentals trump everything, right? The fact that wind and solar do not compete and is starting to come to roost. The mm-hmm. fact that EVs don't make sense.
For everyone.
You saw the Hertz thing.
I did.
Right? Yeah. Something that was 30,000 cars. They're getting rid of 30,000. they're getting rid of.
That's a lot, right?
Europe already did it. They did it 6 months ago.
Somebody told me like every one of those things trading for or selling for less than 10 grand.
That's the problem. The resale value was so low that the economics were screwed, so they had to charge three times as much for the rental, which nobody would pay for even when it was the same price.
Yeah, I don't want to have to find a charging spot for the rental. And then if you have a crash, you know, Hertz pays for it. All right, well, it costs three times more to fix those cars because they're unibody construction. You got to replace, you know, the whole half of a car to fix it. So, you know, all of these things, the fundamentals and the math is coming to bear. The problem is it just takes time in some cases. So
wins out.
The oil fundamentals are going to win. I'm absolutely convinced. But, you know, it may take time. On the services side, fundamentals are going to win. You're not going to have enough. You've seen it. I guess the most obvious case is the compression side, right? Mm-hmm. You still, that sector is blowing and going, and you've got a year wait for an engine, right? So, you know, you're seeing clear signs that it's emerging.
And we're not overbuilding in an expectation this time.
Right. And inflation-adjusted oil at 70 is still way below the long-term average.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm absolutely convinced we're going back to $100+ crude. Now, I have no confidence in saying it's going to happen tomorrow versus a year from tomorrow.
Sure.
But I think the die is cast that, you know, over the next few years, the direction is going to be meaningfully higher. And then the only thing you have to deal with in between is, all right, well, we got this massive geopolitical unrest that could cause it to happen tomorrow. That none of us are going to predict the timing of that.
Nope.
You mentioned that you know, Ari, it's all about Iran. I would go one step further. It's look at the drones that Ukraine's launching into Russia, and they're hitting refineries now, and they're hitting ports. That's a way underestimated impact. If you start to restrict Russian production because these $1,000 drones are actually
then you
working,
hurt India and China and people start to squeal.
And production comes down. Biden administration has allowed the energy axis of evil, Venezuela, Russia, and Iran,
to boost production,
to increase 2 million barrels a day
yep.
since Biden took office. Under Trump, those same guys were down 4 million a day.
Yeah.
It's like, wait a minute. At $100 oil, which, again, we're not there today, but $100 oil, that's 200 million a day of, you know, cash.
Well, if we let them grow production, maybe they'll like us and quit bombing us. Talk about not understanding the culture.
Not once have you heard in this whole, all right, they killed our servicemen, what are you going to do about it? How many times on the national media have you seen anyone ask, well, how about you enforce the sanctions against Iranian supply like we had under Trump?
They might get mad at us.
But of course they would. But you know, that's therein lies the problem is nobody's even asking these questions. And that's so if that happened, right, well, then oil's up. Except, Saudi's got a couple million of extra supply, except Biden's really pissed Saudi Arabia off.
Yes.
Really pissed them off with, you know, number one, the SPR release, which no president's ever done that. And it's a direct attack on Saudi Arabia.
Correct.
Number two, we didn't back them up with the military and nuclear backup and everything. So there's a full-blown arms race going on in the Middle East right now to get nuclear weapons as fast as they can. Saudi's going through Pakistan and others, you know, because the U.S.
Iran and Russia signed a joint development agreement.
Right. And third, let's say Iran's up 1.2 million barrels a day, you know, since Biden took office. And again, Venezuela, Russia, you had all those guys, and it's closer to two. Well, who's that come out of? Like, who's paying the price? Oh, Saudi's down 2 million.
Yeah.
You don't think that pisses them off? So do they want Biden back at office?
No.
I don't think so. So I'm because of the geopolitical issues and whatnot and the politics around Saudi and whatnot. I happen to believe everyone's model has Saudi returning to the market in the back half of this year, of 24. They have Saudi coming back online to the tune of 1 million barrels a day in their model. Yeah.
Why?
Well, because we need the crude, and Saudi will just provide the crude. Which I do think they will, but they're not going to do it at $75.
I was going to say, I'd do it too, as long as the price was 90.
Yeah, they're not doing it 75. And therein lies, I think, the disconnect between most every model I see from analysts today and what I view as reality, which is, wait, you're going to really need this at least by midsummer. Wait, we're in the middle of election season. You think Saudi's going to rescue Biden?
No. Hold on, let me think about that. No.
Yeah. So let's take oil to 100, 110. What I don't know, but to me it's pretty straightforward, connect the dots in terms of the geopolitical risk and the push to higher oil.
And your comment on subsidizing the American people? Keep in mind, the way cost curves work, every dollar that the oil industry loses is a dollar that subsidizes the American people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the thing that frustrates me, I mean, obviously they're, you know, let's talk about the shale boom for a minute. You know, people talk about all the capital destruction that occurred during that period of time. But what they don't really acknowledge or talk about is the fact that, yeah, there were some engineers that were probably given way too much money, and yes, there was some push to provide production at any all cost, and some people probably did some things they shouldn't have. At the same time, though, you know, as they say, success looks a lot like failure. I think the amount of knowledge that was gained in that period of time, because as you both know, everybody is party to a lot of their own, you know, a lot of this production out there, you know, through joint operating agreements. So everybody gets to see the successes and failures of one another. And so I think there was a lot of positive information and intelligence gained that allowed us to, the really smart, intelligent players to capitalize on that and take advantage of advancements in technology. So, yeah, the rig count's down, but I think that's a flawed way to look at the numbers these days, because the efficiency gained in drilling, I mean, you can't get any more efficient.
Now the technology hits the market right away. Before EPR, Exxon Production Research, Shell, they all had their R&D facilities, and they used it. They said, okay, Halliburton, you use our technology with us, but nobody else.
Right.
And when they closed all those down, all that technology development went to the service companies, and now we're seeing the benefits of it after several years. Is everything hits public domain. All the technologies are available to everybody.
Right.
You may have to pay for it, but available to everybody right away. And that's been a sea change from when we started in this business.
I was having breakfast with a mutual friend of ours when another mutual friend of ours called us while we were at breakfast. And I said, hey, leave us alone. Don't you know I'm at breakfast with one of your colleagues? He said, yes, I just knew you were going to be there. I had to bitch for a second. I said, well, what are you complaining about? And he goes, we need to tell these damn service companies to quit congratulating all the consolidation and quit capitulating to the rate reduction. He said they're already, you know, we're already giving them 10 to 20, 30% rate, you know, efficiencies in the money we've developed and technology.
Right.
And then we're giving, you know, they're going to continue taking it. So it's not a 5% rate reduction or a 10% rate reduction. It's like a 20 or 25 or 30% reduction in cost. And I don't think people have appreciated that completely.
Well, if you want to see the poster child of that, go look at the seismic industry.
Yeah.
They've done more to lower the cost of finding and producing oil over the last, since the late 90s, invention of 3D.
Right.
And I think two of them make a profit, TGS, and there might be somebody else.
Right. And it's, but it's not, to your point, not just one. It's
the
seismic industry. You look at the days required to drill a Permian well today versus, you know, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
You look at frack hours pumped. You know, 10 hours 7-8 years ago was a good day.
Big day, yeah.
For frack hours under operation. Now, you hear of Liberty and these others going to 20 hours a day. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh my gosh, yeah, well, that's what's driving the efficiencies. Now, last I checked, there's only 24 hours a day. So from here, you know, it may be a little harder to gain efficiency, at least in the frack side.
You can drill a well. We've gone from 20 days to 10 days to 5 days. You still can't drill the well without drilling the well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there'll be a limit to that. Yeah. But most importantly, there's a limit on the rock, right? On the quality rock.
Depth of inventory is the hottest thing going in the market today.
Right. And that's, if you look at valuations of E&Ps, it's all about inventory.
That's
inventory,
right.
inventory.
All that matters.
But then you got places like the Colorado Rockies that are arguably possess some of the best rock in the business.
Yeah.
But they just happen to be in Colorado.
You've got political risk there.
You know, maybe they're just smarter than all of us when you know, oil's at 200 and gas is trading at 20, and they say, you know what? Let's open this up. This can make
now,
a difference to our coffers.
Yeah.
Maybe they're smarter than the rest of us.
Have they figured it out with marijuana? What the heck?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, as we all know, we could enjoy talking to each other all day long, and we've got our audience for a little bit, and I really appreciate you coming on and chatting with us.
Of course.
I think we've covered some of the things we chatted about, but before we let you get out of here, we normally like to ask our guests if there's any nuggets of wisdom or pieces of advice I'd love to share with our listening audience, or even share maybe some knowledge that you'd wish you had known when you were younger that you know now.
Well, first of all, do I get a gift or anything? Like
No.
We bought you a crappy lunch today earlier.
Actually, it was pretty good lunch.
Sure,
yeah, I didn't need that much, but then again, I say that most of the time.
Send you a nice thank you note.
Yeah, do not send me a thank you note. Nuggets of wisdom. It's as a guy that has to deal with a bunch of 20-year-olds coming in. I run investment banking now, so you have a bunch of these young go-getter types that want to be investment bankers. And what I tell, you know, all these kids and my kids as well, right, who are, you know, pretty close to that age, is, look, the best thing you could do for your career is work your ass off the first 5 years of your career. Learn as much as you can. It's not about making 5,000 more here or there. It's about learning as much as you can and cultivating a work ethic. Because when you get into your 30s, you're going to have a family and kids, and you're not going to have time for that. Then you're going to be coaching baseball and blah, blah, blah. So establish your knowledge base, your work ethic, you know, early in life, and soak it in.
Yep.
Enjoy it. That's just one of the things I see in the younger generation. They come in with a focus of, you know, work, family, balance, but they also want to make a crap ton of money. And it's like, well, you know, I get it. I would have loved that at your age too, but there's trade-offs. And if you're going to trade time off, do it early in your life, when, like, really early.
Yeah.
So that when you have your family and your kids and you really need that work-family balance, that you have time to do that. Yeah. So that's just one of the key pieces of advice I give my kids. And
pretty good one.
And like we said before, when you interview people, find out about the culture of that, you know, entity. Because the culture really matters in wherever you're going to go work. That's it.
Amen.
That's all you got? I mean, it was good. Don't get me wrong. But really, that's all you got?
That's... I'm sure I can come up with a lot more, but most of it's not appropriate. And so since this is not a Chuck Yates podcast,
yes,
I'm not going to go there.
Well understood. Well understood.
I got to ask you, I understood our dear friend Chuck might have visited the LLR the other day.
Chuck's been down there. Lavaca River Ranch is my ranch that I own with a
He missed our week. He was supposed to be there.
Oh, that was what I was inquiring about. I thought he was
there. He was supposed to be there.
Weather got everybody.
Well, no, it was actually his, he was going to London and he needed to get his passport expired.
Oh, that's right. He had to get his passport last minute. It expired without him knowing it.
And I love him to death, and he's so much fun. Imagine having, me and Jim and Chuck and, the other characters we had.
Turbity
and, around the campfire.
Okay, Turbo there?
Yeah, it's just a disaster waiting to happen, but a lot of fun. So, yeah.
I need to catch up with Chuck. He's been way overdue.
I look forward to it next time.
Yeah, and that you've seen the ranch, so you know what an environmentalist I am. The amount of habitat we've done and created just for these poor animals. I mean, if we put a lot of money in this, so these people that accuse us, you're just a bad oil and gas guy that is destroying the planet. I'm like, actually, no. I'd be happy to show you.
That's conservationists our
spending on all the stuff to improve habitat for these things that I'm trying to kill.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fantastic. I really appreciate you coming on and joining Jim and I today.
Love you guys.
Thanks, Marshall.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And look forward to having you on again.
You bet.
All right, everybody. Well, thank you for tuning in to the Oilfield 360 podcast. Jim and I have got some more exciting guests coming up soon, and we'll have to talk to you next time.
Look forward to it.
The Oilfield 360 podcast is brought to you by the following sponsors: Locked In Global Energy and Marine, uncommonly independent. Locked In is the world's largest privately owned insurance broker and risk finance advisor. Locked In's global energy expertise is centered in Houston and represents the largest concentration of energy specialists, clients, and experiential knowledge in the upstream, midstream, and downstream segments of the oil and gas industry. Visit LockedIn.com for more information. Upright Digital. Upright Digital specializes in partnering with your business to maximize marketing efficiencies. We have a deep understanding of people, their needs, motivations, behaviors, as well as the technologies that enable brands in many industries to utilize what is available in a changing digital landscape. Find us online at UprightDigital.com.